Digital 410 proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are back live, as we are every Monday, and I want to welcome each and every one of you back. Joining us from Texas is our friend, good guy, Jeff Copsetta, and of course, Henry Sledge. Jeff, Henry, how y'all doing tonight?
Really good.
Yeah, hanging out with you guys every week.
Every week.
Yes, sir.
Every week. Oh boy, it's been a busy week. My brother's coming in town. He's actually drove from Vegas. He arrived sometime tonight. I got the roofing company coming out finally. It's been since last September. I'm finally getting the roof replaced after a hurricane. I'm putting up a lot of background noise. Sorry, I got distracted. And I'm getting new internet. So if you guys are tuning in and there's issue with the audio, it's because the fine people at Comcast throttle my bandwidth because I use too much of it. And so we're moving over to fiber optic tomorrow. So I got a busy day coming. Hopefully next Monday, if there's any sound issues tonight, that'll all be resolved. But enough of my complaining. Jeff, what's going on in your side of the world?
Well, man, I don't really have anything to complain about. you know, just going and blowing, doing what we do here, and look forward to talking about it and hanging out with you guys tonight. And, you know, been hearing back from a lot of our listeners, which is really cool, really encouraging. Got some great messages over this past week. So, yeah, got some cool stuff to talk about.
Oh, there I am. Fantastic. I actually muted this to turn up the volume on YouTube to make sure the audio is coming through. So that's been checked in real time. Henry, what's going on in your side of the world, fella?
I'm doing good. It's just a pleasure to watch you keep the plate spinning with all your producer stuff, man. It's so cool to see it. I don't see how you do it.
It's something. It's all I can say. It's something.
What are you drinking right now? I got to ask. I've been meaning to ask.
You can take the boy
out of the mason jar.
You can take the boy out of the trailer, but you can't take the trailer out of the boy. I'm drinking wine out of a mason jar.
I like it. What kind of wine is it?
I keep saying true crimes. Real crimes. I don't know. It's one you get at the grocery store for like $10. It has the mug shots from like the 1930s and 1914.
Nice.
Yeah, true.
I like it.
And well, true crimes, I think.
Yeah, true crimes.
I think it's called true crimes. Yeah.
And if you get the app on your cell phone and you shine it at the bottle, the mugshot actually animates and starts giving the story of the person who got arrested. It's a whole thing, but I never did the app. But it's $10. It's good, and it fits in a mason jar. So
there you go.
Well, I guess anything fits in a mason jar if you try hard enough. That's a lesson for the kids. So you posted some... were they updated? Did you post more photos from the event you talked about last week, or did you have another event that just rolled through, Jeff? I think I saw a couple more photos coming up.
I probably posted some stuff from leftover, maybe from the air show. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, and your son, I saw, posted some stuff of him and his airborne stuff on Instagram as well.
Yeah,
was that from the same event?
That's a different event. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Unfortunately, I could not be there this time, but Logan got to go in my place, which is really cool. Him and his best friend, reenactor buddy from high school here. So yeah,
is that the one that got folks, to ride the plane in his German uniform and sliding around with the hobbledale boots on?
Yep. Yeah. The last.
Yeah.
Group of riders to ride in Texas Raiders. Yeah. So, it's a back-to-back from Blue Bonnet Air Show. The following week is always an event around here called Magi, and a lot of our listeners from Texas will know that. Magi is a really cool museum. It stands for Museum of the American GI, and it's on private land. This guy, I have no idea how many acres he's got, but he just built this huge metal building. And he's got a really great little PX in there. Always has some great souvenirs and books and things to buy. He's got a really cool. I don't know if it was a temporary display or not, but last time I was there, he had dog tags hanging that represented every guy that was KIA in Vietnam. Just, I mean, what a 58,000 some odd sets of dog tags. It was a really, really powerful exhibit. And then you kind of go out to the rest of this huge, almost like a hangar, really, or like a barn dominium type building. And just half tracks and Shermans and M5 Stuarts, and he's got a running French Renault tank from World War One. He's got an AH-1 Cobra hanging from the rafters. Like,
basically, he would have what we would have if money was no object.
Right, right. And, you know, it's one thing to just have really nice-looking vehicles curated in a building, but once a year, this event here this past weekend, he rolls up the doors and everything drives out. And so you've got all these vendors, and it's right there in your College Station. So if anybody knows, you know, Texas A&M, it's that area there. So the A&M Corps cadets come out. They'll set up paintball ranges for kids. There's all kinds of vendors with things to buy, uniforms, equipment, et cetera, you know, the things that you would see at a Living History event. And then later in the day, they do a huge battle. And it's really cool because they kind of do a parade of vehicles first, and the guy that owns the place, he'll narrate it. He's got a little microphone. Everybody can sit in bleachers or hop up on the hood of your Jeep or whatever. And but they kind of give you a little background of each vehicle as they drive by, right? The half tracks, the Stuarts, the Shermans, the M10s, the M18s, you know, and then the German vehicles. There'll be Schwimmwagens out there and German half tracks and things like that. And then they kind of get set up and they kind of set the stage for what you're about to see. And then it's just 150 dudes with way too many blanks and too much fun just going at it. And, you know, they've kind of set, you know, it's coordinated, of course. So there's little set vignettes that are happening on the battlefield that are kind of, you know, pre-rehearsed or whatever. So you see this, this amazing display of just infantry and, you know, armor support and artillery pieces. But he's also got a really nice World War One battlefield that he built just behind that. And they'll do two different types of reenactments throughout the weekend. It's open for the weekend there, Saturday and Sunday. So just a really, really cool Living History event. It's very popular. And again, you know, College Station is in that area of Texas where it's you're kind of 2 hours to Dallas, Houston, Austin, you know, just those big cities. So it pulls a lot of people. You know, and you can get on there and you can apply if you want to be a tank driver, a tank gunner, a tank commander. You know, there's just this application process. So he pulls a lot of, you know, living, you know, guys from other Living History sure. units. Patton is always out there with his Third Army. And I know there's that 6th Armored Recon Troop or something, 6th Cav, whatever it is. I know some of the guys over there and, you know, just people from everywhere going in their ETO uniforms, wolves and having fun. So, yeah, Logan got to go out in his Pathfinder uniform, which if you've seen the picture, man, he's got a heck of an impression for being 16 years old. he's really narrowed his focus to 507th Regiment. So he knows the drop zone. They're just west of the Murderet River where they jumped in. And they hit their DZ. They hit on time, which is kind of interesting. You don't really hear a whole lot when you talk about the 506th.
Yeah.
You know, missed drops all over Normandy, but 507th hit their target on time. And you know, they're Pathfinders, so, you know, setting up those Eureka beacons. He was kind of walking around, and I think somebody had heard his name or his last name, and like, hey, you know, Jeff Cupp said, he's like, yeah, it's my dad. You know,
that's cool. I'm happy he got to experience that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it was really cool. And he actually ran into a few reenactors that worked with me when I was still over, you know, at the Nimitz. We've got one guy, he's active Army right now, and Logan recognized him. He's a real tall guy, right? Really tall. So I always call him Too Tall. So Logan, hey, Too Tall, and he came up and goes, only Jeff Copsetta calls me that. You know him? I was like, yeah, it's my dad. You know. So it was really cool just to hear, you know, oh, yeah, your dad's on What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. Yeah, it's awesome. So, yeah, just to hear stuff like that at these Living History events. And, Don, I know you get to do it, I think, more than I do. And you've been obviously doing this podcast a lot longer. So I know you've had those experiences. But, you know, it's really nice to hear words kind of getting out.
Yeah.
And we're appreciated by these guys that, and we appreciate them working hard, putting these uniforms together, these impressions, doing the research, spending, you know, my gosh, the amounts of money that we're dropping on eBay and wheeling and dealing. And it's just, it's cool. It's a really cool community to be a part of.
You know, one of the hard things down here, which probably super cool there with the guy owning his own land, but like when we're down here doing Living History events, most of it's at a park or a museum or some sort of private, you know, public owned land where, you know, you're lucky, maybe you can dig a foxhole more than not. And I always think of this, like, the coolest living history photo I'd ever seen. It was World War One, and it was just at a park. It was at property somewhere, probably over in Europe. Guy was doing World War One. He literally set up a circle of sandbags and then brought in, I'm assuming he brought in because it's nice grass, and then he's just literally sitting in a, I don't know, 10-foot diameter circle of sandbags of just mud and clay, just like, you can tell it's like 4 inches deep, and it's realistic, you know, the crap that those guys fought in. And so he spent his weekend just sitting in this mud, giant mud puddle to recreate that environment. And it's so cool to see that, but it's so hard to do in real time because most places won't let you destroy their soil or make that kind of a mess on their property. So everybody always has the fantasies of going out and digging foxholes and making a big mess, but at most places they won't let you crack that shovel.
I can see that really cramping your style. I mean, if you guys are trying to put together an event, you know, with accuracy and a feeling to it, man, I mean, I could see that really limiting you.
Yeah, the best you can do, because you can clean up it easily, is, like, obviously most of us have tents set up. You make kind of like the bivouac area.
Mm-hmm.
Just be a complete absolute slob when it comes to your tin cans and your empty gear and all that crap. You just eat your peaches and just drop the can, because that's what you would have done in real life. It's not like you would have collected it and went and put it in the trash can out in the jungle. It's like, kick it in a pile. And then at the end of the weekend, you just kind of muster it up and throw away. But, yeah, A couple years back, I was at an event where they had a tree line, and they let some people, you know, some of the younger cats want to sleep in a foxhole. And so I was dumb enough to let somebody borrow my e-tool, which was a reproduction, which, if you don't know, reproductions are not made to the standards of original or even a shovel you buy at Lowe's. And so, long story short, it came back with the handle snapped in half, and like the I was like, oh, God, that's...
What is the reproduction cost of one of those?
About as much as an original. Seriously, really? They're about $60, $70, depending on where you get them at. And so I kept the spade off that one, then I bought a new one, and then I was at an event somewhere, and someone had a whole stack of the shortened, just the replacement handles, like for the airborne. And so I bought a T-handle shovel. I just got to find an error-correct rivet. I don't want to put like a bolt and a nut through it because they have their rivets. So I got to find a error-correct rivet, which I think what I'll do is I've been thinking about, because I have so many damn M1 helmets that need restored, it would cost me a small fortune to send them out. But I do know Jay Murray sells the equipment and even the punch, so I might get some of that stuff and redoing some of my helmets and maybe use that. See if that punch will work on an industrial size rivet to put the handle back in there. But I haven't done anything down here. I had somebody reach out to me, ask me, say, like, "Hey, are you going to this event in April?" And I had to tell him, and I feel bad because he lives in Naples. He lives 45 minutes further south than me. But I just told him, I said, "Man, with the way everything's going, with paying, you know, deductibles on two cars plus my roof, and then my monthly nut going up with insurance raises, like, this year is not going to be the year for me driving 3-4 hours in a V8 truck." And, you know, be honest with you, a lot of the biggest expense of living in history after you invest in your gear is the food and drink to support your ass for 3 days, you know? You're out in the sun, so you got to buy cases of water and all that stuff. So I just told him, I said, hopefully next year, but right now, any extra income I'm going is, you know, getting all this crap. And, you know, we're still suffering from a hurricane down here, which sounds crazy, but, like, my brother's come down here from Vegas because we were initially supposed to basically gut my dad's house and refit it. And so I was planning on doing drywall work this weekend, but luckily my dad got a little bit of a FEMA check in. So now we're just going to go there and put the outlets in, and he's going to pay someone else to put the drywall up. But yeah, like, this whole area is just now really starting to get construction and everything going back from suffering through the hurricane, which, by the way, I don't know if we have people in Mississippi and Georgia, but our hearts go out to the people in those towns affected by those tornadoes. Seeing that footage is heartbreaking. At least down here in hurricane country, our houses are built out of cinder block with rebar and concrete poured down the center for hurricane codes. Those poor bastards are living in woodstick houses, and there's nothing left. I don't know if you guys seen any of that footage coming out of Mississippi or Georgia, but those tornadoes just annihilated those areas. It's just sad.
Oh, it was an interesting night. It went north of us, but we were preparing to batten the hatches down the other night.
Yeah.
But like I said, we were lucky on this one. It went north.
Yeah, I heard it was a big, big guy. I heard it was pretty damn wide. So
yeah.
Thoughts and prayers to all them. Real quick, I want to give a shout out to our listeners. Like, somebody went on a shopping spree over like the last week. We've been moving some t-shirts and we want to thank you guys a lot. There's not a whole hell of a lot of margin in that stuff, and we're not trying to make bank off t-shirts. We're more interested in the fact you guys are, you know, grassroots advertising, because I mean that's what shirts are truly doing. It's getting the word out there, spreading the word. I've had people comment about my hat, what's that, or the logo on the back of my truck. I'm sure Jeff's gotten out once or twice about the sticker on his truck. And so for you guys buying the shirts, I hope you enjoy them. There's definitely a ton of them on there. We got years worth of shirts that we just keep putting up there. Just keep in mind, they are print order. When you order those, I don't have a warehouse full of shirts. That's why we use that service. They are print order. So what they do is you put your order in and they'll wait 3 or 4 days to see if any other orders come in before they go rigging up an entire machine to print one shirt. And then they'll try to, you know, they will, but there's like a 4 or 5 day gap, and then they'll print all of them out at one time and then ship them. So if you order a shirt, there is a little bit of a turnaround time, but that's why. It helps keep costs down here and get shirts out to you guys. And that's what allows us to have such a wide catalog of different logos, because we're not, you know, order them up front and have them sitting around here. It's, you choose the shirt you want, the size you want, the color you want, the quality of t-shirt, put in the order, and they'll ship it directly to you. And there's some mugs on there, the hats. I think there's even, I put some towels up there too. I haven't even checked out, but thank you guys so much for ordering those. If you want to support the channel, you can also go over to WTSPWWII.com. Click on the Patreon link. It's $1 a month. You can sign up, subscribe that way. Or to be honest with you, if I'm sitting here talking about how times are tough right now. Just go watch our YouTube videos. Doesn't cost you a thing, and that goes to help support the show that way too. And we also want to hear from you. It's been a little bit of a dry week for the email. I don't know if the postman's tied up, you know, putting everything on microfiche or what, but the mail call letters have been a little slow this week. So we want to hear from you. Send us an email to mailcall@WTSPWWII.com, or you can send it directly to our Instagram page and our Facebook page. I can't believe I went completely blank on that show we've been excited about the British special.
Rogue Heroes.
Jeff, you got a Jeep. How much wind blockage do you suppose that grill blocks from your radiator? It's a weird question.
Yeah, it is.
Well, here's why I bring it up. Because the British Special Forces cut out all those supports except for one. And so when you watch, and I bring it up too, because one, I noticed on the show, but since the show kind of got popular, I've been seeing more photos of people's recreation of those Jeeps on it on Facebook now. And they're cutting those supports out, and they're painting whole damn things brown. And the only thing I can imagine, the only reason they cut those supports out was to increase wind flow because they're driving through the desert. But I can't imagine, I don't know how much increase it would help.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Interesting. I mean, from my perspective, so, you know, my Jeep only gets so much air going through the grill because it's my truck towing it.
Yeah, trailer queen, do you?
So, well, it's not even on a trailer. I have a hitch that it just bolts onto the bumper.
No,
and
no,
then
no.
Hooks on. And
I saw that photo. You got to tell people that's the knockdown piano wire from the road.
Right.
Keeps you from getting decapitated.
Yeah, no, that's. Yeah, that's just my little Air Corps Jeep. I mean, it's going to be so stripped down that it's going to look so unique, because everybody that I know that has a Jeep, they've got gun mounts, they've got 8 Musette bags hanging off of it, and jerry cans and spare tires and ammo cans. And like, mine's just going to be like, hey, I'm going to fit 10 guys in an air crew uniform to hop on and drive from briefing to the bomber. Like, that's what mine's going to represent.
Well, that's usually what happens to Jeep drivers at large-scale living history events, especially at airports. Hey, Jeff, I'm in the parking lot. I got a lot of crap to carry, or bivouacs 2 miles away. And you're just constantly picking people up all day long. Because that's what we would do. We'd call Chris or one of the other guys, like when we'd go to Sun and Fun and all that. It's like, I'm not dragging all this crap a mile and a half from the parking lot to where we're set up on the runway. And he would come and schlep you and all your gear back and forth. So that's what happens to a lot of those Jeeps. But I'm thrilled that you're getting it, you know.
We're getting there.
Getting
it's
reliable.
Process. It's process. It's not the only old vehicle I got to maintain. So it's you know, I got to pick and choose the time that I have and what's the next event, what do I need it for, and which one's which. And Yeah, but it's a cool problem to have for sure. But I was telling Henry when we first started, and Don, I haven't had a chance to really ask you this, and you probably know, right? I mean, of the three of us here, you guys, I feel, have seen, I mean, obviously Henry's in a different category, but when it comes to the Pacific miniseries,
in the box,
Don, I think you've probably seen it more than I have.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume. Mm-hmm. So, because I've probably only seen it maybe six times.
I think I watched it six times before I got the box set as a birthday present one year. So, no, I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen it quite a few
times.
There
you go. And I don't watch like an episode here, an episode. Like, if I'm going to watch it, it's going to be, you mm-hmm. know, over the course of like a week. So it's a year. I watch it probably once a year, you mm-hmm. know, unless it's like something special. Like my brother, when I went up to Jersey that one time to see my brother, I was like, all right, dude, you're a former Marine. You've never seen this. We're going to sit here. We're going to make a bunch of, well, we're going to drink wine first. We're
gonna out drink of a mason jar, of course. That's how we do it here.
And then we're going to drink a ton of coffee and we're going to watch the Pacific. And nothing else is going
to
stop us.
By the way, if you're listening to this podcast and maybe your uncle owns a vineyard, if we can get together and come up with Mason Jar Wine, that'd be a great brand for us here at WTSP. Be the WTSP Mason Jar Wine. You know, we can work something out. But, yeah, so you get your popcorn, your wine, and you guys put the cucumbers on your eyes, and you put your hairs up in a towel.
Little exfoliation. Right? So, all right. So I've been talking about it for the past few weeks. I'm taking it slow. I'm still reading with the old breed. I'm in no rush to finish it. There's times where, and you know, right? So, you know, all the distractions I've got here, right? All the everybody running around and yeah. there's a new puppy. And so I'm like, man, I feel like I've read this same paragraph 14 times. That's because I have, right?
Somehow my dog, by the way, found my bookmark. Carrie's like, whose bookmark is this? I'm like, where did he find that? So the new Boston's like into everything. Like he found my missing bookmark. So
did he eat the bookmark?
No, he's
sorry,
just,
Jeff. I don't
just,
even mean
he just drugged it outside where he takes okay. everything. If you're missing anything in the house, go look out in the backyard. It's probably sitting there. But go ahead, puppies. We love puppies here on the What's sense. The Scuttlebutt podcast.
So
ooh, real quick before we get back to it, can you make dog tags for our dogs? You have a stamping machine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You need to make us some WTSP Ooh. Dog tags for our dogs and one for me too. That'd be cool.
Yeah, y'all send me the info, whatever y'all want on it.
Yeah.
And we'll do it. I'll knock it out next time I'm out there for sure.
Sweet.
I don't know why I didn't think of that sooner. Golly.
Some dog.
Let's see, where was I? So yeah, all right.
Dogs, kids.
Watching the Pacific.
One read a paragraph, same paragraph at the time, wine, cucumbers, exfoliant. Pedicures, manicures.
Repeated interruptions by Don.
We're used to it. We're used
Which
to
we
it.
Have all to right. forgive because he's the producer. So
exactly.
He gets to do what he wants.
I've been downgraded to the producer.
Well, you're
producer's one step up from an intern. I should know. I was
I'm
a producer
sorry.
For 6 years.
What would be the exalted title you would prefer? I'm sorry. I didn't
host? I mean, look at
okay, host. Host. All right. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Man. Okay. So, yeah. Let me spit it out before I lose it again. So I just saw that our good friend, you know, said. Freddie Joe Farnsworth just celebrated a birthday.
Aww,
so
he's old.
He is. I texted him and I said, man, you are gracefully transitioning from USMC to AARP.
If you want to know how old he is, go back and watch the box set of Band of Brothers. You can see him as a young guy at the boot camp. He owned all the actors.
Right. So I saw where... you know, in the Pacific, I think it was We Happy Few that posted on social media about him playing or portraying Lieutenant Stumpy Stanley.
Stumpy Stanley, yeah.
And it kind of like, wait a minute, something's not lining up in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm at the part in your dad's book where they've come back from Peleliu. They're in between Peleliu and Okinawa, so just read the forward. Uh-huh. For the Okinawa portion, right?
Okay.
And so just dealing with all of that, geez, that healing or supposed to be a healing process for him. The part where he just dug Men at War book by Ernest Hemingway out of the trash can.
Right.
Okay. So, guys, and you're probably going to laugh in my face, and you have every right to. But the lieutenant that the first line is to your father when they're standing there getting their grapefruit juice from the Red Cross nurses.
Right.
And he's whatever. He's like, all right, guys,
you've had your look.
Yeah. Yeah, you've had your look. Right. Guys, I thought that was Hal Dane's replacement as the company commander. I thought that's who Lieutenant Mac was.
No. Mm-hmm. He's just the guy whose job it is to make sure the guys don't get out of line with the Red Cross nurses.
Well, he's the officer that you see for the rest of the series.
Is it?
Oh. Well, Mac was actually kind of a... They did a little bit of that character compression thing there, Jeff.
Okay.
I know... Like that scene where they're getting off and the girls are handing them the juice.
Yes, I remember now. Yeah.
I mean, that really happened. Mm-hmm. Okay. They filmed it just the way it happened. The lieutenant, because actually that's a story Dad told me when I was a kid, you know, okay, you've had your look. Come on, Sonny, move out. Which he called him Sonny in real life in the book, as you just saw. That was not Mac in real life. Okay. But as we know, you know, because they had to use that character for a couple things, and especially on Okinawa. Have you gotten to Okinawa yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah. There, you'll come to another lieutenant, or maybe, see, here's the thing. This is what's confusing me. I've got to go back and I'm pressing through on my project, as y'all know, but there was another guy that my dad called Shadow. And I can't remember if Shadow was in with the old breed.
I know the name does not. That must have been one that was pulled out of the original. Because that name does not ring a bell at all.
Yeah, Shadow was a guy who's actually named George Loveday. Not at all a very popular officer at all. And there's a lot in the unpublished stuff that goes into that, and I'll touch on some of that. But Mac had the bravado, and he was the one who was always talking about, you know, the first Jap I see, I'm going to charge him with my K-bar, my 45, and, you know, Snafu and my dad and all the guys who've been through, they're just rolling their eyes like, you got to be kidding me, man. And but he goes on to say Mac really wasn't a bad guy. He actually ended up being a pretty good officer, but he just had to kind of, he had to get broken, you know. But
well, a lot of that, too, is to build up their own self-confidence so they can, you know, perform in the way they think they should.
Right.
So this guy, this name Mac, he doesn't really exist in real life.
No, he did exist in real life.
But what Henry's saying is they use the actor to play the two roles just to get that one scene out of the way. So
Jeff, you know, in part, I'm sorry, don't go
ahead. No, go ahead.
In part 9 on Okinawa, when you see the Japanese charging down the hill and you see Sledge with the M1, you know, wait, they're close. That, and then you've got Kathy, the machine gunner, you know. They did a lot of, like, and they did this with some of Leckie's characters, too. There was a lot of, like, combining characters and taking things that happened to somebody else, but putting it on a character they had, as we've talked about, you know, just because you can't have 20 damn named people per episode. But the officer who comes along and, I sent you up here, observing you up here with a goddamn sidearm, and you just gave away our position.
I was here to kill Japs, so it doesn't matter what kind of weapon I use. That's it.
Exactly. So they've got Mac doing that. But in real life, it was Lieutenant Loveday who actually, or Shadow, who came along the line when they were emplaced up near Half Moon Hill on a little escarpment. And he just came along the line just berating and cursing all these guys as they're firing at the Japanese coming out of this culvert. And,
well, I mean, he's also the one that, you know, gives the fire mission that your dad calls to drop the mortar in on the house with the caved in roof.
I need a round to the right of the house with the tomb. Yeah.
Right. He's also the one that threatens to court martial him the next time they touch a Japanese prisoner. So, I mean, he's around so much. He's the only officer that they really, gets any kind of light on Okinawa. So I just assumed this is Akak's replacement because I don't remember I don't remember, and I feel bad saying this on the air. If Freddie listens to this, like, sorry, dude. Like, I don't remember you in the Pacific.
No, his scene was, he had one line, and he talked about when he's on the show. Basically, or Freddie talked about, I guess when Freddie was supposed to, he's basically a guy who relays the mission to AKAK, and then AKAK relays it. Like, Freddie, it was like a literally three line.
Well, no, AKAK was gone at that point. Remember, AKAK was killed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was, anyhow, it was like a three line, just, it was real quick.
Yeah, so. The thing was, Jeff, I think...
Because Stumpy's the XO.
Yeah, but he ended up taking over K Company. I think they had to use Mac because they wanted to show an officer doing just being an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And that was accurate, right? But Stumpy Stanley was very highly thought of. Lieutenant Stanley was very well thought of and a respected guy and a respected replacement for Captain Haldane. But... I'm like you guys, I didn't even realize Freddie Joe had been in the Pacific until I circled back around to all this and started really watching it and then getting to know him. And I'm like, oh man, you mean that was you and partner? Like I said, this is it. Where's the rest of your guys? Like I said, this is it. You know, and like you just were remembering, Don, Freddie Joe didn't even want to do that scene, but he was the only one who could even yell loud enough to be heard over the tanks and the Amtraks.
Yeah.
And so he's like, okay, fine, I'll do it. But yeah, I mean, Lieutenant Stanley, if they had given Okinawa more airtime, which they probably wanted to, and then the budget limitations just cut it shorter than they wanted to be, then probably Lieutenant Stanley would have had more of a role,
you know,
I think.
That's kind of a good hypothetical mind game. It's like, I was going to bring this up later. So the new project that Hanks and them have been working on for the Air Corps, it appears to be a Disney Plus project now. It doesn't look like it's going on HBO. I think I saw
Apple TV, isn't it?
Apple. Oh, sorry, Apple TV.
Apple TV.
I get them all confused.
But I knew HBO did not want it.
Well, that was my question. I didn't know if they didn't want it or if they couldn't match the budget because these streaming services make so much more money compared to the cable services because a lot more people are quote-unquote cutting the cord. And so that was a fun thought is if the streaming services were around back then – and there was more money being thrown around to get new projects, would either the Band of Brothers or the Pacific been either longer or had more bigger budget because the money that would be available to do it like the new ones now?
I can remember when the Pacific came out in 2010, everybody was comparing. And look, there, like we've talked about on this show before, there was a lot of antipathy toward the Pacific because people were like, well, it wouldn't like Band of Brothers. Well, you know, Band of Brothers came out and people got the box set and they watched it on TV. There was no streaming in 2000, right? Well, or 01, whenever it came out. But when the Pacific came out, streaming was starting to get to be a thing. And so I remember some of the naysayers, I mean, people who were just panning it and really not wanting it to succeed, saying, well, you know, the first, like the average number of viewers per episode with Band of Brothers was X number of million.
No, it's because less people had HBO.
Right. And in the Pacific, those numbers were a lot lower. And you had people coming back saying, well, look, man, people are not, they're not subscribing to HBO and watching this like they did 10 years ago at that time, 10 years before. Because you have streaming. It's just people are consuming it in a different way.
And you also got to remember at the time, HBO was the pretty much only cable show channel doing the Deadwoods, the people want to kill me, the mobster show,
Sopranos,
Oz, all the, they were groundbreaking with all that stuff. Oz, the Sopranos, Band of Brothers, Rome, which killed Deadwood. All they were the only channel out there doing that kind of work, and so since they were the only ones doing it, that's where you had to go to see it. And so their subscriber base. Well, I mean, for the longest time, from like the 70s until probably the mid-2000s, HBO was the premium cable station that you had to get if you wanted to see anything, whether it was Star Wars, all that stuff. It was on HBO. That was the top of the stack for cable premium TV channels. And by the time the Pacific rolled out, more and more people were people were cutting the cords, but now you had other stations doing that type of work. And by the way, when it's not the Band of Brothers, well, you know what is? the Band of Brothers. So go watch that. And then, you know,
and I will say, I think a lot of those people, a lot of that negativity worked itself out. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of those people became converts, me included.
Yeah.
As we have discussed, and I've discussed it with other people. Jeff, we were kind of jumping around there. Did I address where you were going with your original question?
He couldn't figure out who Freddie Joe was playing.
No, I knew who Freddie Joe played. I just, when I saw that and I saw the name, and I'm literally at that point in the book where Stanley is, you know, goes from XO to the CO, of course, mm-hmm. the moment Haldane goes down. And yeah, so I was just thinking like, oh, that was the guy. Because I didn't know Lieutenant Mac. I didn't know his name. I never caught that kid's name.
Well, they don't call him that. They don't call him that.
So I just assumed he was the new CO. So when I see Stanley's name come up in your dad's book, I'm like, oh, that's what that cat's name was. Then within a day or two, I see, oh, you know, happy birthday to Freddie Joe, you know, who played Lieutenant Thomas Stumpy Stanley on the Pacific. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. That's not who I thought it was. Who the heck was the CO of K-35 if not Lieutenant Mac? It should have been Stanley. So I see what they did there, and I can appreciate it more because – it would be very – so the first time I saw the series too, it was very confusing because I was – I was expecting Band of Brothers, different uniforms, different setting. Yeah. So it did take a little bit, and I did read Hugh Ambrose's The Pacific prior to ever seeing the miniseries. I didn't know
– that probably didn't help your level of confusion.
No, not at all. Not at all. That was what I assumed the Pacific was. I mean, it was supposed to be that. So, but look, I've never had streaming services or HBO or any of that stuff, so I was never on – I mean, if it didn't come on, like the TV, if I had time to watch TV, I didn't see it.
Yeah.
I didn't get on YouTube and watch stuff. You know, so – I was kind of behind the bar there. So, yeah, I read Hugh Ambrose's book, and it was a picture of the cover from the movie, right? The dust jacket. So I was like, oh, this, I got to figure out a way to see this thing. But I never saw it until my wife bought the box set. I don't know how many years later. So I just, I went by what I remembered from that, and I had the DVDs of Band of Brothers. So, it was... I guess disappointing is it wasn't my expectation, but Henry, I think, makes a good point. And I think a lot of us were like that too. This isn't Band of Brothers. It's not supposed to be Band of Brothers. It has nothing to do with Band of Brothers. This is how the story needed to be told. And I see now, I appreciate it so much more every time I do a little deep dive and every time I do watch it. I appreciate it more and more for those nuances, kind of like that too. Lieutenant Mac and his character and the different people that kind of got compressed into who he was really helps keep the light bright on Haldane.
Yeah.
Because to really accurately, I mean, we all know Scott Gibson. I can't even say enough about how he portrayed Haldane, right? If you have that similar performance and Lieutenant Stanley, like you said, was an outstanding CO on Okinawa, you already have so much confusion. You're trying to keep up with who the heck is who. You know, it's just all the guys in green for most of the civilians watching it, right?
And helmet.
So if you have these two really outstanding company commanders, they're going to start bleeding together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just my assumption is maybe that was kind of done to – you've got Haldane. You know who he is. And then you've got the fresh kid that just got his lieutenant's bars – that's not a bad guy, just a little green, you know, at Pavuvu, and actually does a good enough job. I mean, I don't see him being a terrible commander in Okinawa. It wasn't like this guy was just trash. It wasn't like the winners to Lieutenant Dyke situation.
Yeah.
Right?
There's a lot more in the unpublished stuff on Mac, and you're correct. He was not a bad guy, and I think by the end, my dad even – And the other guys, too, when I speak of my dad, I'm speaking more collectively. There was a level of respect for him, but they were really leery of him, too, because by then, these guys, some of them had been through Gloucester, certainly Peleliu. In my dad's case, he had just been through Peleliu. You know, they were not looking for a CO who's like, I'm going to put my cable, you know, and all that bravado crap. But they had to, as far as the Pacific, like, I go back to what I said. I'm telling you, I think the original intent and if Bruce McKenna were sitting here, he could probably confirm this for me. They probably wanted to do at least two parts on Okinawa.
Yeah, because they did two parts on Peleliu.
Huh?
Yes, because they did two parts on Peleliu, so it would have made sense that they would have done, because they spent so much effort getting that mud correct and the set design.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
and
sure.
And I think just budget started getting tight, and they had to go with what they had. But they had to have that Matt character because they needed those disreputable or undesirable traits in an officer so that certain other things could be portrayed. One of them, it highlighted what a good officer ACAC was. But, you got to have
the
Matt character.
Huh? The yin to the yang.
Exactly. You got to have the Matt character. I send you up here. You're supposed to be observing. Then, because you got to have Sledge saying, what differences make what weapon? And all that really happened. I mean, it really happened, as you will see, Jeff. I mean, you've read the book already. I mean, this isn't new to you. Like Don said, the end of the yang. So
it makes perfect sense.
Another fun character to look for, because when you watch the series, he's there, but you don't realize he's there until the P-48 wing, when Gibson's behind the chicken wire.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, well, who the hell is this Gibson cat? And then you go back, oh, he's the guy who shot the cow from the train, and then he's the guy who choked out the sick Jap at the...
Oh, yep.
And so when you go back and rewatch and you're actually actively looking, you can see his change in personality from the way he acted on the train versus that. And you can, but when you're watching the first time through, you're like, I don't remember this cat.
And Don, until you said that, I never even realized it. And then I'm like, wait a minute, that's the guy Don's talking. Oh, wait, he's the dude who chokes the guy on
and
the
he's the guy who
shoots. Yeah.
Yep. And Lecky's all pissed off that he shot. And perfect example, it's hard to believe they did this, but it's not. Speaking of people who are left out, if you read Helmet for My Pillow, one of Lecky's best friends, other than Chicken and Chuckler, was a guy named Red. And he's not in the story at all. He's not in the Pacific at all. Like the whole thing about him and hiding under his helmet, and they all played a joke. They kicked his helmet off and shot up at the Thompson, and he freaked out. All that stuff about Red. And just, I think it was actually the scene where Lecky is in Gloucester, and his boondockers get stuck in the mud, and he says, kill me. Would somebody be a good guy and kill me?
Yeah.
That was Chicken, or that was either Chuckler or Red who did that. I think it was actually Chuckler who actually said that. He was mired down in the mud. But once again, it was one of those situations where the action and the story was more important than who it actually happened to. And so why not put it in this scene where Frenchie does what he does instead of creating four scenes to tell that story? Just, okay, the story's the important part, not who said it. So we'll just add it to this scene and get that across. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, we tend to kind of overlook the fact that they're finishing up the series too. They got to have Iwo Jima on here.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
you had to have whatever, like 6 minutes of Iwo Jima to tell that entire story to wrap up what Bastalone has going on. I mean, there was so much. I'll be honest. I don't know if I could have taken another Okinawa episode, man. That was so intense.
Yeah.
The civilian consideration, man,
And, when they go in the hut and the baby's crying and my dad holds the lady. I mean, I remember Bruce telling me how they were going to change that because, as you will see, and you probably remember anyway from having read WTOB, I mean, that's not what really happened. And he and I kind of argued about it a little bit, but he said, no, trust me, Henry, we wanted to show your father's empathy more than we had. And so here's how we're going to do it. Trust me, it works, And we see it.
Scene reminds me of, and it's similar but not at all the same. That scene reminds me of the scene in Platoon where Charlie Sheen walks into the hut and the Dylan's brother comes in and they have that conversation. It's very reminiscent of that scene out of Platoon.
I know what you're with, man, with it's Bunny. Been a long time.
Yeah, Bunny comes in. Platoon. It's very, very similar. It's almost like the when they were writing a screenplay, did they read that out of your dad's book? I mean, it's different, but very similar.
Her head apart, though. Either.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying the whole thing up until that part, it's very similar.
Yeah. It has the same feeling to it. Watching it again and seeing that scene, I mean, it was beautifully shot. Yeah. I mean, when he lays the Tommy gun down and that ray of light is shining right on the Tommy gun, and you see his finger come off.
Yes.
I'm a little surprised that didn't get more notoriety.
Yeah.
In a good way. I mean, it was just a really, I mean, it's a deeply personal thing for me, you know, because I know it pissed my dad off when that guy, and little tidbit from the unpublished stuff, my dad talks about the guy who shot that woman in a little bit more detail, you know, as I bring into my manuscript. But
since we're on the topic of books in the Pacific, you guys see the picture behind me?
Love it.
For those listening to the audio version, what is that picture behind me, Henry?
That's pushing up into Guadalcanal. I've got my dad's copy of the old breed, which is the 1st Marine Division unit history. And I want to find that very picture. And I know we've talked about this.
The picture's poor Sid's cut off because of my background and the way Zoom works.
Okay, I was about to say, I can't see Phillips in
there. That's the picture where Sid Phillips is allegedly urinating. And he refers to it in his book, You'll Be Sorry. And on the reprints, that is the cover. And so for most the part, history has said that is day one on Guadalcanal after the beach landings. As what platoon was Phillips in? Do you remember
platoon? I'm not. He was H21.
Yeah, H21. So he was company H Company.
Second battalion, first marine.
Second battalion, first marine.
Same as Lecky. Yes.
And if you actually Google Sid Phillips USMC, that photo will come up. And in the book, he says, how do I know it's me? He said, because I remember I was taking a piss, and everybody said, well, you're famous now. He said, what are you talking about? We saw the flash bulb, and one of his guys asked the photographer, why would you use the flash in the jungle in the daytime? And he said, it removes the shadows from the foliage, and that's how Sid knows that's him urinating. Sorry, Jeff. The reason I bring that up, Henry, you're writing a book. We've had plenty of authors on. How important is accuracy in photographs in a book about history as far as getting that right?
Well, it's important to me. After we discuss this, can I show this picture that's up and read the captions that Sid
actually
Phillips
please read on? It now, because it'll go to reinforce what I'm talking about.
So here is, and this thing's getting old, but all right, that's the same picture. Can you guys see the handwriting on it? All right. That's Sid Phillips. This is my dad's copy of this book, but he sent it to Sid. Sid wrote these notes in it, and Sid sent his to my dad. I've told you guys that before. All right, so the caption to that photo, Don, the actual caption says, relief moving up. Men of the 7th Marines take a break before going forward to relieve another Marine unit. All right, in his handwriting, Sid wrote, no, H21, 30 minutes after landing on Guadalcanal, August 7, 1942. And then top of the next page, I was told somebody had just taken our picture and, quote, Phillips, you're going to go down in history taking a leak, end quote.
And what was the original caption under that photo that your father said was wrong?
Well, Phillips said it was wrong because my dad wasn't going. Yeah, but it says, relief moving up. Men of the 7th Marines take a break before going forward to relieve another Marine unit.
Okay. The reason I ask is I'm staying with the boys, John Bazelon's story.
Yeah.
And his unit didn't land until September 18th. But we know that photo was taken on day one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading this book. Page 185 has that photo. And the caption underneath it says, Sergeant Bazelon's 1-5 Marines on the trail to Makinaku. So they have completely misidentified that photo. Now, I doubt the author did that. I'm sure it's probably somebody at the publishing house, the editor. Someone decided to put that photo in this book and state that was the that was 1-5 and that was Bazelon's group.
So he's saying Bazelon was in the 5th Marines.
It just says Sergeant Bazelon's 1-5 Marines on the trail.
Yeah, that'd be 1st Battalion 5th.
1st Battalion 5th Marines. Well, because he was on Guadalcanal, he got reassigned before he went to Okinawa after the drive. But the fact is, they didn't land until September 18th.
No, but Bazelon was 7th Marines. He was under Chesty Puller in 7th Marines.
Okay, so
right, Jeff.
Well, I can tell you because I looked.
I thought.
He was under Puller because he has a lot in here about Puller.
And Puller was not 5th Marines. He was 7th Marines. And then Puller took over 1st Marines before Peleliu.
Yeah, so the photo is wrong in two ways. It says Sergeant Bazelon's 1-5 Marines on the trail. And so I was like, I doubt the author did that. Somebody at the editor or the publishing just threw that photo in there for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But
I mean, Don, I'll tell you, and our buddy Dave Holland is not a big fan of that book.
Yeah. Well, it's a great photo, but, and I'm enjoying the book, but like I said, one of the things that caught me off guard is it's written in the first person, but we know Bazlone didn't survive. And so, like, okay, I suspended my belief. I'm the author's doing a good job. I'm believing he just got a shitload of information from the family, and we're going to take everything at its word. But then you get to a well-publicized photo like that, and it's completely misidentified. Like, okay, well, is everything else in here cool? So that's just it's just one of those things that bumps you. You know, it's like I'm taking everything at its face value in here, especially the, you know, a lot of stuff that's being portrayed in the words of Bazlone, and especially when it comes to chase and tail and all that stuff. But but then when you get to a photo like that, that's well documented, that it's on the first day of, you know, D-Day and who it is, and then like, well, there's Bazlone's fifth, you know, it's like. But it's not taking away anything from the book. It's just interesting that something like that would end up in this book.
I'm just surprised they're claiming Bazlone was in the 5th Marines. Well, I mean, that's a pretty
not
big...
in the book, but just in that photo. So that just goes to show you. I don't think the photo was submitted by the author. I think somebody at the publishing house put it in there. Maybe they're trying to balance out the pages. I don't know. Somehow that photo got put in the book, and it was misidentified in two different ways. And it's just like, okay, come on.
I think it's extremely important because, I mean, from like living history reenactor perspective, guys are picture thumpers.
Yes. Right?
It's on this picture. Look. And okay, great. However, what, you know, think about what, like, that's a perfect example. The caption of it says this, but actually, and you know, we've had Scott Freund on here before. And, you know, he's a perfect prime example of somebody got fed up of, you know, wanting to watch a documentary about Midway. And, you know, they're showing footage from, you know, kamikazes off Okinawa, or, oh, this is the battle for Tarawa.
Like, yes.
No, that's no way, shape, or form Tarawa. Like, it's not even close to Tarawa. So,
well, here's the big red one landing on D-Day, and they cut the films of Marines on Guam. It's like, what?
Right.
The hell?
Yeah. I mean, it happens, right? I mean, that stuff happens all the time. So, yeah, I think it's really important because a picture's worth a thousand words, like they say. And how many people sit there and read these books cover to cover? They just look at the pictures and look at the caption, like, oh, okay, that's that. And it's in a book. It must be right. And, you know, you guys have read enough and you've been around it long enough. And I hope all of our listeners are kind of the same way. Like, you have to take every book at face value. And I don't mean to discredit any memoir.
Yeah.
But let's face it, that war is this big.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how everybody, you know, how people perceive things, how, you know, Don and I can watch the same hockey game and get two different things out of it. He's going to see it in a different light than I'm going to see it, and we're both going to try to explain it to somebody else in a different way. And so say, look, I was there at this hockey game, and this person's taking notes, and what I said to them is only how I saw that.
There's your perspective.
Perfect example. Perspective. Thank you, JT Rocker, who is joining us on YouTube. I was wrong. I was said that it was either Chuckler or Red that said, be a good guy and shoot me. And JT Rocker pointed out, actually, it was Hoosier that said, shoot me. So, per example, even my memory, even seeing that series and reading the book, it was Hoosier that actually said, be a good guy.
So, in the book, it was Hoosier who said that?
Yes. And not, and not Leckie. So
see, I just reread Helmet like last summer. And I got to reread it.
Because you had Hoosier, you had Chuckler, you had Red, you had Chicken. Because, you know,
and J.P. Morgan's made up, right?
Yes.
Yes, he is a made-up character. Yes, Joe.
He's a made-up character because the guy that he was based off of did not want to sign over his likeness rights to HBO. I saw that in an interview. It was somewhere I was watching a video. I may even have been about the making of the Pacific. It was somewhere they're talking to I saw a video somewhere on YouTube. It was talking about Bazlone and his friends, and the guy who was one of Bazlone's friends who helped informate. He just, for whatever reason, didn't want to sign over his likeness rights, and so they said, "Okay, you're now." And the fact that he used J.P. Morgan, which I think was dumb, because like that's the guy who made J.P. Morgan Chase. Is that who that is? The famous banker? It's like, why wouldn't you choose a more generic name, not one that's, you know, J.P. Morgan? That's a huge name in the financial world.
Yeah, it really is.
It's like, oh, wow, J.P. Morgan. J.T. Rocker said, it's like the beginning of Ken Burns' The War. The Second World War II was fought in thousands of places, too many for one accounting, to Henry's point of, or Jeff's point of it being such a, you know, small view of a big war. And so appreciate JT coming in, and shout out to Brian Larkin too, who was talking in the chat. So,
that's my cousin.
We're loving having the chat here. And now that we're centralized and we're just streaming directly to YouTube now, everybody can come and join in the conversation. So thank you guys so much for joining in.
That is cool. I like having that.
Yeah, super cool. What's up, Brian?
Jeff, you
want... he's a big fan. He's a big fan of the show, and he's got a really cool and I think I've shared on the show before. So Brian's father, you know, Brian's my cousin, so Brian's father married one of my dad's sisters. Well, his father is named after his father's uncle, who was killed at the opening stage of the Battle of the Bulge. And I think I shared a picture with you guys that I had somebody colorize. So, yeah, he's got a really cool link to World War II.
I want to get your go ahead. I thought you were done. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No.
I want to get your opinion on a living history display item. So as you guys know, I've talked about this in the past. One of the things I was super happy to get with was an original fixed bail front seam helmet, yada, yada, yada. Got my plastic Hollywood Holly liner in it, blah, blah, blah. A couple months back, I came across another fixed bail helmet. The liner's not correct, but one of the bails is missing. Now, I bought replacement bails, and I know a guy who can weld. But I thought, why not just sew a chin strap on the one bail that's on here, leave the other bail broken off for the time being, and use this as an example of why they got rid of the fixed bails, because they tend to snap off. Instead of restoring it temporarily, just tie one strap on there and take it to living history displays along with the other one, showing how easily those things broke off, and maybe even use it as a raggedy-ass Marine impression with having just the one strap instead of taking it over to my welding guy and have him weld a new bail on there. What do you think?
Nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, you know, it's a great educational tool. I think, you know, you're really reaching an even smaller population of people that, you know, about a fixed bail helmet. You know, so I think that's kind of an interesting thing. It's either that, or I'd have a little table display of a chunk of plywood or some wood from a ammo crate, cut a hole in it, and have your steel pot upside down. There's a kitchen sink history display too. It doesn't matter if it's got a chin strap or not.
Well, one of the things I like to do, because I have different impressions, especially because I have so many damn Marine Corps haversacks, is I like to show the differences, especially the Marine Corps is well documented. I like to show the differences in haversacks from the beginning of the war to the end of the war, when materials got more strict, harder to get, and more importantly, when it comes to the haversacks, they need equipment done quickly. And so when you look at the early haversacks, they got the nice flaps that fold in, and by 1945, it was basically a potato sack that fold over with some straps on it. And since I own that stuff, I like to show people, here's how it was at the beginning with the... They had, you know, Lagan's a perfect example. They used to have the nice brass, more expensive claps on them. By the end of the war, it was just black metal. Just get it done, get it produced, and get it out there. And showing that it's a way to offer a little bit different display opposed to everything else people have. I like to show the difference between, you know, the, because people don't think, oh, web gear is web gear. First aid pouch is first aid pouch. No, not necessarily. Marine Corps had a different pouch, different color. Their web belts didn't have U.S. stamped on it. And if you have it, it's one of those things I like to point out to people. And so I thought it'd be kind of cool, too, to have, here's the fixed bail helmet. And the reason they got rid of the fixed bail helmets, guys would sit on their helmets. The bails would break off. That's why they went to swivel bail. And here's an example of a fixed bail helmet where the bail's missing, which is why they ended up going to swivel bail after a while. Just like the reason they got rid of the Holly liners and went to the, you know, the compression liners, because they found out quickly that, oh yeah, paper doesn't hold up in humidity very well, especially when you're doing amphibious landings.
Right. Yeah, and you know, I think it's always been interesting too. Marine Corps impressions are always, there's got to be something that a little, you know, odd or unique about it, because they had to be such scroungers, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think, I wouldn't say if I saw, you know, a living history display, you know, of a guy portraying a Marine with an Army pistol belt or with an Army first aid pouch on there, something like that. It's not something that's like, oh, that's wrong. No, nothing wrong about it. They were stealing everything they could from the Marine, from the Army, right? So a Marine impression, you can easily make the case to have one or two pieces of Army gear on there, but it doesn't go the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, you can't have 29th Infantry Division you know, with a Marine Corps piece on there, like,
And the Marine Corps is even more, like, okay, if you're doing a Guadalcanal impression, you got to have the white t-shirt. You can't have the green t-shirt, because the green t-shirt didn't come out until Peleliu, and you got to have, you know, this canteen flap cover, because that canteen flap cover didn't come out until this mission. Oh. You got to have this.
Yeah, they had four canteen covers.
And but Guadalcanal. I can't do a Guadalcanal impression because I don't have a 1901 Springfield. I only have an M1 Garand. So the Marine Corps stuff's really hard to pinpoint a certain mission.
You stole it from the Marines.
And my dad's HBT cap. The guys we've talked about, his HBT cap is an Army pattern.
Yeah.
I believe.
Well, the early Marine Corps ones were. They didn't have the EGA on them.
Which it I didn't know. Army. I didn't know that until you pointed out. It wasn't until they put the EGA logo that they moved the stitching over, because the stitching was in the dead middle. And so once they adopted the silkscreen EGA, they had to move the stitching over to make room for that. But I never realized that until you pointed out, Henry, I think when Henry's on like the third, fourth time, I had my P-44. You're like, no, that's the P-44. The original ones were all the same. It didn't matter if it was Navy, Army, Air Corps, you know, the mechanics. Well, the mechanics had a longer build. They had a little bit different, but yeah, all the rest of them had the same hats on.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I that's what makes Marine Corps impressions so cool, I think. I mean, hey, you stole from an Army dude or, you know, whatever, because you had six Marine divisions fighting alongside 22 Army divisions in the Pacific. I mean, they crossed paths so many times. They're out there getting all kinds of stuff, swapping whatever,
not to mention
trading off. And
the George F. Elliott got sunk with all their gear on it. So by that time,
and all our ass wipe.
Now, Don, you brought up something interesting. I didn't realize the green t-shirt came out at Peleliu. I thought it didn't come out till 45.
It may
Iwo.
Yeah, it may have been. I think it was Iwo. You're right. It was Iwo, because actually you can see in the series when Bazalone goes to Pendleton to start training, that's when he's wearing the green t-shirt. But yes, and it makes sense, because you're in the jungle. You got this bright white shirt on before you get sweaty and dirty. You basically have a nice white target right over your juggalo for a sniper. But yes, early on, and like, you have to have the white shirts. And of course, I have the ones, if you get the authentic ones, they have the real big necks on them, so you can fit them over your helmet. They're super
wide. Is that
wide.
Why they did that?
I'm speculating. I don't know. I speculate, because it only makes sense if you think about it. They got these big white-ass necks on them, and let's look at the trousers. Everybody thinks the Navy's the ones with the quote-unquote bell-bottoms. No, if you look at HPT pants or wool pants, my hypothesis is the legs are so damn big.